So it looks like from the homework and your debate preparation and stuff, you're already going to know a bit of what I'm going to say. So my plan is just to kind of ramble about some stuff that wasn't necessarily covered in the homework. But if there's anything you specifically want to talk about, just interrupt me at any time. You all know quantum theory pretty well by now, I guess. And the kind of central tool that you use to calculate things is the quantum state. And I guess the kind of reflexive thing to do with the quantum state is just to treat it like the kind of central object in any other physical theory as just being the kind of thing that tells you what's going on. The trouble is, if you think about it a bit more carefully, quantum states don't really behave like the states of reality do in most other physical theories. In fact, they behave a lot more like probability distributions do. So one example would be that specifying a quantum state requires an exponential number of parameters in the number of systems. Normally you would expect your description of the system to say scale linearly with the number of systems. But probability distributions do require an exponential number of parameters. Another example is that if you have a bipartite system, you do a measurement on one system, you change the quantum state for the other system. It's a bit of an odd thing to happen if you've changed something real on the other side of the system, but if it's like a probability distribution, then it's totally natural that if two things are correlated, when you learn about one, you update your information about the other. And so this kind of raises the obvious question, well, are quantum states just actually probability distributions? And a framework to address that question is called the ontological models framework, which I think Lucian's talked to you about already. And within that framework, you can make a distinction that you were talking about in the debate between a psi epistemic model and a psi ontic one. And so in a psi ontic model, quantum states are probability distributions. You have some state of reality lambda, and when you prepare some quantum state, that might only tell you some probability distribution for what the state of reality lambda is. But in a psi ontic model, if you take two different quantum states, the probability distributions don't overlap. And so if you have a model like this, it doesn't really kind of vindicate those ideas I was talking about for sort of why the quantum state behaves like a probability distribution. For example, if by measuring on one half of the system, you can choose between or affect which of these two quantum states applies to the other system, you can't just say, oh, well, I'm just updating my information about what's really there, because there's no possible state of really there that's compatible with both of those quantum states. So to really do justice to those kind of analogies between quantum states and probability distributions, you need that the feature of quantum states overlapping is mirrored by the feature of classical probability distributions overlapping. And so if psi and phi are non-orthogonal states, you'd expect it to look more like this. Okay? And then in some situation where your measurement on one side affects whether it's psi or phi on the other, it could just be that the state of reality is, say, this one here. And it's unaffected by what you did. You just assign a different probability to that, depending on which one it is. Okay. And so the natural question then arises, well, can you actually come up with an ontological model like this? If you look at the sort of kind of ontological models that people normally talk about, they end up looking like this. Things like Bohmian mechanics, collapse models, those kind of things. And so it's not actually obvious that this is even possible at all. It turns out it is. There's paper by Lewis Jennings should really know how to spell my old supervisor's name, but I by these guys. And they kind of explicitly construct a model like this for finite dimensional quantum systems. But it's kind of a bit of a mess, like doesn't really have any nice symmetries or sort of look like a kind of thing that you might actually think a quantum system is. And so you might want to sort of finesse that question a bit and say, okay, we know both types of model exists, but can you have models of this type that sort of have nice properties, like that you might actually believe in? And so then you're into the realm of what are sometimes called Scientology theorems. Which generally take the form of imposing some additional assumption on the ontological model's framework and then deriving that this is the only sort of model that satisfies that assumption. And there's now quite a lot of these things. So if you're interested in this topic, I'd recommend Matt Leifer's review article, which is this thing. It's quite long, but you can get quite a lot out of it just by sort of leafing through it. The Scientology theorem I'm going to talk about now is the one that I did with these two guys, sometimes called the PDR theorem, which you can find in this paper, although it's explained quite nicely in this review article as well. Okay, so as I said, the game with these things is normally to impose some sort of additional assumption. And the additional assumption that we imposed is about how product states are modeled in the ontological model. So if you have a situation that you would model using this quantum state in quantum theory, then according to the standard ontological models framework, there's just going to be some probability distribution, what should I call this? Rho, maybe. There's just going to be some probability distribution for rho over some ontic state, lambda. Okay? And this lambda is just supposed to describe the entire system, and there's no particular restrictions on what this guy is. But if you think kind of physically about how you can go about preparing a product state, it could be that you have one preparation device here that you've built yourself, and then it could be that some aliens in Alpha Centauri have built their own preparation device using completely different techniques. Yours prepared psi, theirs prepared phi. And so it's kind of a little bit odd to think that the only way to talk about that situation is just by this big ontic state that applies to the entire thing and some distribution over that ontic state. Kind of a much more natural description of, like, if I kind of cartoonishly draw some boxes for these two preparation devices, the kind of natural thing that you might guess is going on is that there's just some system that comes out of here that can be described somehow, and that there's some system that comes out of here, and that since these two things don't really have anything to do with each other, the distribution over these guys is just going to be the product distribution. To actually run the argument, we need to then bring these two systems together and perform some kind of measurement on them. So we're kind of assuming that not only are there these kind of isolated descriptions of the two systems, but that if you bring the two systems together, those two isolated descriptions are kind of enough to make predictions about that joint system that you've formed. So kind of the, like whether you believe the conclusion of, if you've accepted the ontological models framework, then whether or not you believe the conclusion of the theorem depends on whether or not you believe this assumption. I think it kind of passes the first test, which is that it kind of doesn't obviously, like, I haven't just obviously imported the assumption that quantum states are real. For example, if you look at Rob Speckan's toy model, which covers parts of quantum theory with a psi epistemic model, it does satisfy this assumption. But there are legitimate questions about whether this is really a sensible way to think about product states in light of Bell's theorem. So it's certainly not a completely uncontroversial assumption. I guess that's all I'll say about it for now. So what can you actually do with this assumption? Well, a psi epistemic model, by definition, has to have a pair of quantum states that are represented by overlapping probability distributions. So I'll just draw that again. And now, if we have one system where we're choosing to whether we're going to prepare psi or phi, we can consider another system where we're doing the same thing. So I'm just using the same model for both systems. And now, by this assumption here, sometimes called preparation independence, if I want to know what the joint state for these two systems are, it's just the ontic state from this system and the ontic state from this system, and their probability distributions I just get by multiplying these two probability distributions. Unfortunately, 2D graphs are a bit beyond my artistic abilities, but if you imagine multiplying this function by this function, you're going to get something that's like non-zero in this region. So this is going to be what psi tensor psi is represented by in the ontological model. Similarly, if I do the product of this and this, I'm going to get something here. The next two guys, something here. And The last two ones, phi and phi, are going to give me something here. And so you see that just kind of inevitably from the fact that these two guys overlap and that I'm just forming the product of them, I end up with this region here. That's in all four of these squares. And what that means is there's some, if I prepare psi tensor psi, say, which is this square, I've got some chance of being in here. If I prepare this square, I've got some chance of being in here. In fact, for any four of the squares, I've got some chance of being in here. So these ontic states have the property that they could have come from any four of the probability distributions. Okay, so that's fine. That's just a kind of natural thing that happens when you have overlapping probability distributions. But that actually causes a problem when you think about what quantum theory tells you about these four states. So those four states are these guys. And it turns out that if the overlap between psi and phi is small enough, then these four states are what is sometimes called PP incompatible, which sounds like a bit of a mouthful. But all it means is that if you have a quantum system that you know is prepared in one of these four states, you can always rule out one of those possibilities. Okay, so in other words, there exists some PAVM with four outcomes such that first outcome has zero probability on the first state. The second outcome has zero probability on the second state, and so on for the other two outcomes. Okay, so whichever outcome occurs, and one of them's got to occur, you can rule out one of these four possibilities. But in an ontological model, a measurement just has to respond to the ontic state. And so if the measuring device gets an ontic state from this region, the fact that it's inside this square means that it can't give the first outcome. The fact that it's inside this square means it can't give the second outcome. You can probably see where this is going. The fact it's in this one means it can't give the third, and because it's in this, it can't give the fourth. So within this region, there's just no outcome that you can assign a non-zero probability for the measurement that has this property. And so this measurement just can't be adequately represented in an ontological model that works like this. So pardon? That's what?
Okay. how does this theorem work when, I mean, you can do all this kind of, the states that you write down, the measurements you make, you can put the limit on this.
This measurement is not in the toy model. And in fact, it kind of has to not be since the toy model works. It's kind of almost dangerously close to being in the toy model. It's quite fun to kind of play with the toy model and work out why it's not in there. So if you take the quantum states 0 and plus, which are in the stabilizer formalism, and work out what the measurement you need to rule out one of the four possibilities you get with that is, you get a measurement that's basically in the stabilizer formalism. You can think of it as being a measurement of one Pauli operator, and then based on the outcome of that, a measurement of another Pauli operator. And in general, you kind of expect that anything that's in the stabilizer formalism will have an analog in the toy theory. But this is an example that doesn't.
What is the stabilizer formalism?
For qubits, it's, do you know what the Clifford group is? Or the Pauli group? So the Pauli group is just tensor products of these guys. And the stabilizer formalism deals with states that are simultaneous eigenstates of sets of Pauli operators and the unitaries that preserve that property, basically, and measurements in these bases. So it's like a small part of quantum theory that you can efficiently on a classical computer.
Am I right in thinking if you put that in your block sphere, it becomes like the octahedron with the vertices and the axes?
So the only single qubit states in the stabilizer formalism are these six ones. Okay. So I guess now I'll try and get into the nitty-gritty of how you actually construct that measurement. And it's kind of easiest to sort of draw it as a quantum circuit. So one thing I haven't said is that I said if the overlaps are small enough, then those four states I listed are PP incompatible. But for a model to be psi epistemic, it just has to be that some pair of quantum states is represented by an overlapping probability distribution. And so it could be that those two states actually have quite a large overlap. And in that case, you just have to consider more systems. Okay? So if you consider n systems, then you just write down a list of the like 2 to the n ways of combining those two quantum states on those n systems. And that whole list, there'll be a measurement that always rules out one of the states on that list. Is that reasonably clear? So for three systems, your list is going to be blah, 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 blah. Okay, 8 of them. And for any overlap between psi and phi, there's some n such that this list becomes PP incompatible. And the sort of critical point at which if I write So since we've got two quantum states here, they always span a two-dimensional Hilbert space. And then you can just always choose a basis for that Hilbert space such that the two states are these guys. And the sort of critical point at which you need to increase n, the number of systems, is given by this equation. And actually, if you think about it, I only need to show you that the list is PP incompatible at these points. Because if you have a pair of quantum states that isn't at one of these points, then there's some states with more overlap that are one of these points. That makes sense. So if you like, if I draw a line, this formula is like defining a set of points on this line, and whatever the overlap is between the two states you're interested in, you can always kind of round it up to the nearest point for which this formula holds.
So sorry, I'm just getting slightly confused. The idea is we've got two completely arbitrary signs by
now. Yeah.
Rather than I know like the easy way of doing this group is just a bit of like 0 and 5. And you're saying that you can construct a measurement that doesn't work by taking n copies such that this formula holds. And then kind of like
so yes, basically. But the problem is that n is an integer, and so there's only a like discrete set of thetas for which this formula holds. And so what I'm saying is, if you have a pair of states that doesn't satisfy this equation for an integer value of n, then just pick a value of theta that does satisfy it. And then just notice that there's a channel that takes any pair of states to any other pair of states with a larger overlap.
So this is basically an argument against the idea that someone might look at this as a simple version of the proof and say, well, okay, those two states don't overlap, but maybe some other two do. So now you're constructing a way of showing that those two do.
Okay, so we've started with our pair of arbitrary states. We've put them through a channel to kind of round them to the nearest value of theta that satisfies this equation, and we've written them in this basis. Okay, and now to actually construct the measurement, it's easiest to draw it as a quantum circuit. So, these are the n systems. I'm going to apply a big gate across all of them. I'm going to apply a Hadamard gate to each one. I'll get to that. And then I'm going to measure each one in the computational basis. And this gate here is, so in the computational basis, it just looks like this. So it sends the all zero state, it gives a minus one phase to. And all other computational basis states are unaffected. So you can kind of think of it as a controlled, 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 controlled Z gate, more or less. Except that it's controlled on zero, and the phase goes on zero, rather than the usual way around. Okay, so that's our circuit. And now, what I need to argue is that, so it's kind of designed so that the labels for the outcomes match up with the quantum states in the obvious way. So it's designed so that if I put all psi's in here, then I never get the all zeros outcome. If I put psi phi psi psi in here, I never get the 0 1 0 0 outcome. And so any outcome of these computational basis measurements at the end is going to rule out some combination of psi and phi on the input. And in fact, I really only need to argue that it works in this case, that putting in all psi's never gives you the all zero outcome here, because if, say, this one was a phi, then the way I've written these two states, to go from psi to phi, you just apply the z operator. So saying that I put phi here is the same as saying that I put psi here and apply a z. Both the z operator and this gate are diagonal in the computational basis. So this commutes with this gate. If you don't know already, you can check that the product of Z and a Hadamard is the same as the product of Hadamard and an X gate. Basically, the Hadamard just swaps the X and Z bases. And an X gate just flips the outcome of a computational basis measurement. Okay. So when I'm talking about computational basis measurements here, I literally just mean measuring in the basis that I'm denoting by 0 and 1. The Hadamard gate is this guy. Whoops. Z is this guy. So when I apply it to this state, it does nothing to this term, it puts a minus one on this term, which gets me to this state. And X is just this, which you can see is just swapping 0 and 1. And you can just check by matrix multiplication that this is true. Is that okay? Cool. Okay, so the whole argument now just rests on showing that when I put all psi's in here, I never get all zeros out at the end. So to work out the probability of that happening, I just need to look at this amplitude. This is the all zero outcome on the measurement. Let me actually just write out so this notation just means this guy tensor producted with itself n times. So this is just psi. And then in between, there's the circuit. Okay. And if this amplitude is zero, then the probability of this outcome is zero, okay, because it's just the mod squared of that. It's kind of easiest to see what this circuit does, sort of applying it backwards on the outcome rather than on the state. So the first thing, if we go backwards through the circuit, the first thing we've got is that bunch of Hadamards there. And a Hadamard sends the zero to the plus state. And so if I have a whole bunch of zeros and I apply a whole bunch of Hadamards to it, I'm just going to get a whole bunch of these guys, which means I've actually just got, like if you imagine taking this and tensor producting it once with itself, you're going to get 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. So if I take n of these, I'm just going to get a uniform superposition over all of the computational basis states. Okay, so I can just write that as like this. So I've started with the all zero states. I've put it through all those Hadamards. I've now got a great big superposition over all of the computational basis states. And now there's this entangling gate. And all that does is put a minus one phase on the all zero state. So if I just pull the all zero state out of this sum and write it here separately. Okay, so all of these ones are unaffected, and this one gets the minus sign. And that's it, okay? So now all I have to do is this inner product. This bit, like, it's kind of easiest if you start by imagining what happened if I hadn't pulled this out, okay? If this sum was all the way from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1, then you're just going to add up all of the amplitudes in here. So you'll have I forget about this factor in front. It's not going to matter since the answer is going to be 0. But actually, that's not quite right. Because it only goes from 1 up to 2 to the n minus 1. And so the term that came in here from having all zeros here, which would just be all causes here, shouldn't actually be there. So I'll just subtract that back out. And then if I actually look at what happens when I take this term and it interprocts it with this, the only state, right, like the only thing that the all zero state overlaps with in here is just this term tensor producted with itself n times. And we've got this minus sign here. So that's just that. Okay. So this amplitude is just this. And now I'm just going to pull out cos to the n theta over t, I think. Yep. Okay, so here we just get a minus one from here and a minus one from here. So it's minus two altogether. If I pull out a cos theta over two from here, I just get one. And sine divided by cos is tan. So this is just tan theta on two. And then I just noticed that tan theta on 2 plus 1 is 2 to the 1 over n. That was the condition we used to define n. So this amplitude is zero. The all-zero outcome can't happen. And as I argued, that means that for all the other things on the list, some other computational basis outcome can't happen. Is that reasonably clear? Yeah?
It looks like you need the relation between n and theta to be exactly that, to be a strict equality.
Yeah.
How do you make that happen? Can you explain that again? I think you mentioned, because theta is given to you, right? And for a given theta, you may get a non-integer n.
Yeah. Yeah, so you look at your model, you find some psi and phi that if it's a psi epistemic model, they're represented by an overlapping probability distribution. And then, as you say, there's no guarantee that the theta that you would get for these two states satisfies that equation. Kind of maybe worth drawing what those solutions look like. Kind of something like this. So these are the only points where I've actually given you the full argument for how it works. So now, if you have some theta that's here, what I said you should do is just pick the kind of next value of theta that does satisfy this. So you're going to go from here here. Okay, so what I'm saying is take your original pair and then find a pair that has less overlap but that does satisfy this equation. And then I just briefly said that there's a channel that actually achieves that transformation. The way to see that is, so I have some pair of states psi phi, psi and phi, and I want to send them to some new pair of states like this. Well, just take your psi, add some ancilla qubit, and the same for phi. And then I'm just going to demand that this first qubit, that if the first qubit starts in psi, it goes to psi primed. If it starts in phi, it goes to phi primed. Don't really care what happens to the ancilla. And there's going to be a unitary that does this, provided that this transformation preserves the inner product between these two guys. So the inner product between the initial things is just this. The inner product between the final states is needs to be equal for this to be a unitary. And so as long as this overlap is bigger than this overlap, then this is going to be a number whose absolute value is less than one. And so there will be some A and B that satisfy this. On the other hand, if I tried to jump down and wanted to make this overlap bigger than this overlap. Sorry, wanted to make this overlap smaller than this overlap, then this number would have to be bigger than one, so it's not going to work. The kind of easiest way to think about what this channel is going to do in the argument is just to think, well, if the two states overlap before they go into the channel, they have to overlap at least that much when they come out of the channel, right? The channel is just going to look at the ontic state and come up with some new ontic state. And so if there's some ontic state that could have happened from either quantum state, that's still going to be the case when you come out of the channel. So it's a little bit hand-wavy. The kind of more proper way to do the argument would be, don't talk about what the channel does to the ontic state at all. Just kind of actually make the channel part of that quantum circuit and just consider it to be part of the definition of the measurement. What's the right thing to say about that? So, the preparation independence assumption really had two components to it. The first was that the ontic state of the joint system was just going to be the ontic state for the first system and the second system. The second one was that the distribution over those ontic states was the product distribution. And so even if you kept that first part of the assumption and just modified the second part, the argument already wouldn't work because basically this step here is just going to fall apart completely. So. You could kind of easily come up with some kind of joint probability distribution that you might say still demands that the marginal on the first ontic state is this guy, and on the second ontic state is this guy. But that could mean it's sort of some kind of shape like this, maybe. And then maybe this one and this one would be some kind of shape like this. I don't know. I mean, you almost have like so much freedom, it's kind of difficult to give a good example. But it's like the whole way that I got this this square where they all overlapped was by assuming that the way I construct these joint distributions was just taking the product of these guys. And if you look at that model by Lewis et al. That I mentioned at the start, it doesn't even satisfy the first part of the assumption. So if you, the way you construct the model is you just have to specify what Hilbert space dimension you're interested in. And if you say that you're interested in dimension 4, the model just doesn't really have anything to do with taking two copies of the model for qubits. So there's no sense in which the ontic state for 2 qubits can be thought of as the ontic state for 1 qubit and the ontic state for another qubit. And so that's how it manages to get this measurement working properly. Yeah?
So I know that, I mean, this is like something that Rob Spector said when he was saying that, you know, you want to find a good reason to think of, to make this assumption. I mean, do you think it's a reasonable assumption to make? And I guess, yeah, do you think there's a reasonable assumption to make? And do you have, I mean, he originally like made this kind of challenge to say, explain it without dealing with the wave function. Do you think anyone's done that?
So I think it is a reasonable assumption to make. Like, for example, one way to make the argument would be, well, look, there's no correlation. If I do separate measurements on the 2 qubits, there's no correlation between those measurement outcomes, whatever measurements I do. And so the kind of natural thing to assume is that there's no correlation between the systems themselves. So I think that's a reasonable assumption. The trouble is that there are lots of very similar sounding arguments that sound equally reasonable, and yet where if you try and impose them in the ontological models framework, you don't just find that you can't have a psi epistemic model, you find that you can't have any model whatsoever. Okay, so that I like if you're really sticking to the ontological models framework, then the kind of lessons of those other theorems, I'm thinking of things like Bell's theorem and contextuality theorems, is that you have to be quite careful about sort of extrapolating facts about the operational statistics and imposing those as facts about the ontological model. And so in light of those theorems, I think it is sort of reasonable to be suspicious of these types of arguments. And my personal view is that in light of those results, it's not really that clear why, if you really do believe in the ontological models framework, you would have actually bought the assumptions for the, you'd have actually bought the arguments for the sort of psi epistemic position in the first place. For example, that nice story I gave about how when you do a measurement on one part of the system, you're just updating your knowledge about the other part of the system. I mean, that sounds great, but Bell's theorem basically tells you that in the ontological models framework, the story can't be that simple. So, in order to be able to sort of understand whether or not it's a sensible assumption, you have to be able to understand why somebody who believes in the ontological models framework would believe in psi epistemic models, and then kind of look at whether it's a reasonable assumption from that person's point of view. But I'm not one of those people, so.
So, leading on from that question, where do we go now?
So I find the arguments for the cytostatic point of view pretty compelling. And so from my point of view, all this is just kind of the final nail in the coffin for pursuing that idea within the ontological models framework. And so it's kind of time to look beyond ontological models.
I mean, if somebody was really committed to an epistemic framework or an epistemic model within the side, within the ontological framework, you could also take this theorem as showing that, as proving that, for some epistemic model which I want to construct, I just have to drop this preparationist independence assumption, which, like you said, it seems like a very natural thing, and it's quite surprising if it should turn out to not be true. But it seems like it's just one more in kind of a long string of surprising things that we're learning about quantum mechanics. I mean, if Bell's theorem shows us that we can't, assign local, local states of reality to everything, and this just shows that we can't do it even if they're initially far apart. Is that
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable way to think about it. But I mean, at some point you have to ask, like, when is the cure worse than the disease, right? Like the whole point of, like, we've got these psiontic models. They're not perfect, right? They like have some unfortunate features, and it kind of looks like, oh, well, hang on, a lot of these weird features seem to be because it's taking the quantum state to be real. Like, let's make that better by constructing a psi epistemic model. But if it turns out that a psi epistemic model has to be even uglier than a psiontic model, then what would you have actually achieved? So that's why personally I think it's better just to move beyond ontological models.
Okay, so on that note, let's thank Matt for coming up. And to say thank you, we have a picture of you.
Thank you.